You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. Welcome as well to the fourth consecutive last week of summer, depending on how you define it. And so I guess in Montgomery County, we're done. Virginia's still, the kids are still enjoying one more week. Hopefully some of them are watching on C-SPAN to celebrate their final week of summer vacation. We're glad to have you all here, and we will be involving you, including on the C-SPAN telecast in the second half of our program. We're going to talk today about the broader federal budget, but we're going to begin with the specific issue of the Pentagon budget, and even more specifically than that, essentially the war budget, or as it's more commonly known these days, the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund. That is a $60 billion a year thing. It was close to $200 billion a year at the peak of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's still a lot of money, but it's roughly 10% of the Pentagon budget. But as you think about how to address the issues associated with this particular fund, you wind up needing to talk about the entire federal budget, and certainly the Budget Control Act, which has given us the pleasures of sequestration and such things over the years, and which could still do so again. Just to remind you, this crowd probably needs a little reminding, but the Budget Control Act would still be in effect for the entirety of the next president's term in office. And so today's discussion is going to be about whether that's a good thing, whether we should revise it, repeal it. That's where we're going to wind up. And of course, that raises questions about what's the proper level of domestic investment and of national defense spending and of the entire federal budget for the United States. And so that's why we have this distinguished panel with broad-ranging expertise. Let me briefly introduce each of them, and I'm just honored and thrilled to have all three of them with me. And then we'll go to a discussion amongst the four of us. I'm going to ask each one of them a question or two in broad terms to get things going. We'll talk for a while and then involve you with your questions and concerns. The lineup begins with former Undersecretary of Defense Robert Hale, who is now at Booz Allen Hamilton as a senior fellow. Booz Allen Hamilton has been an important participant and contributor to our defense industrial base project here over the years. We've done events with Bob before. He, before this job, as I've said, was the comptroller of the Pentagon, the chief financial officer for the Pentagon, during the 5 years of greatest fun that one could have possibly had. You know, Bob's a Stanford grad in mathematics. A lot of us, when we think about Stanford these days, we're thinking about Katie Ledecky. For all the pain that she's gone through in the swimming pool in her great training regimens, I don't think it begins to compare to the pain that Bob's gone through in trying to endure sequestration, because he was the guy at the Pentagon who found a way to survive it. And some people would say he almost did too good of a job because it almost made sequestration seem tolerable in that year in 2013 when we had it once, and therefore we've come close to having it again. To remind you, sequestration is the automatic spending cuts that kick in to bring us down to a lower spending level if there's no other deal, and this is all necessitated by that Budget Control Act from 2011. And Bob's just been a distinguished and, as I say, very patient and very durable government servant on some of the toughest issues in finance and in management of the Pentagon throughout his career. Previously, he had been comptroller of the Air Force. He had also been the director of the National Security Division at the Congressional Budget Office. Next to him in the middle is Maya McGuinness, my good friend, who's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and she also runs the Fix the Debt campaign. She has been one of the most tireless, maybe the most tireless and persistent people favoring responsible fiscal policy in the United States for the last two decades, and has been exemplary in how she's found many different vehicles through which to get the word out, including through a great deal of writing, a great deal of testimony with Congress, coalition building, working with younger people whose future is perhaps most at stake in many of these conversations. And it's just been an exemplary sort of scholar activist on these very important issues, and thrilled to have her. Alice Rivlin sitting next to me. I get to say this one more time because Hillary Clinton hasn't yet been elected president. I hope she will be soon. That's my own personal view. But until she is, if she is, Alice Rivlin, to my mind, remains the most accomplished woman in American political life in our history. And I'm not exaggerating. She's the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. She was the head of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration. She was the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. And when some people would have called it a career after all that, and interspersed were a number of periods at Brookings when she was writing about important issues of the day, when she quote-unquote retired from the Fed, she decided to help D.C. fix its finances as her retirement pleasure or pastime. And she remains just one of our most distinguished and eloquent voices on all matters about the economy and certainly the federal budget. And so after Bob has started by talking a bit about this specific issue of the Overseas Contingency Operations account, then we will get into a broader discussion about federal budget policy and really federal economic policy and the future of our country for that matter, because that's what it's all about in the end, as you well know. I'm just going to say one more thing before beginning with a broad question to Bob, which is, and by the way, I'm also going to do a quick advertisement for my little booklet, which is about the Pentagon budget, called the $650 billion bargain. Now you know all you need to know. My argument is we should spend about $650 billion a year on our military. That's a little more than we're spending now. Not a lot more, but a little more. And that raises the question, well, if we're going to spend a little more on the military, what about the rest of the federal budget? The Pentagon is only, or DOD is only about 15% of total federal spending. Another 15 or 16% is all the other so-called discretionary spending that we do as a federal government. And that's that term, for those of you who don't follow this day in and day out, means not optional stuff necessarily, but accounts, programs, capabilities that have to be appropriated each year by the Congress. And if they're not, then there's no money. Unlike entitlements, which is, along with interest, the other two-thirds of the budget, which are all the things that we value as individuals, but which may frankly have less to do with long-term national power. So if you're thinking about national power, the strength of the country, at least I think of the military, the highways, infrastructure, science research, federal support for education, which is, of course, a modest fraction of total education spending in this country, but all these sorts of things are in the so-called domestic discretionary accounts. And therefore, to my mind, are not so discretionary. And they're getting squeezed pretty hard through the budget process that we've all come to know and love as this Budget Control Act, with the looming specter of sequestration hovering over our necks every year or two. So that's the broad context. And now I'm going to ask my panelists, my colleagues, to expand on some of these themes and begin with Bob. And Bob, I'd like to begin by noting you've often said that the turbulence in the budget at the Pentagon has been one of the greatest handicaps. Leave aside the level, the turbulence and the uncertainty. Could you explain a little bit more about that problem and how to solve it?
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for the chance to be here. So if I was looking at the next administration and the financial issues they face, by far the most important would be finding a predictable and reasonable level of funding for federal agencies. I'm going to focus on defense because I know it best. As Mike said, since 2010, we've gone through enormous turbulence in the Department of Defense. In 2013, we had the sequester cuts, which harmed the mission effectiveness by not leaving insufficient funds for training. We wasted money, $400 million, paying civil servants during the shutdown when we didn't allow them to work. And it ate up the time of senior leaders, mine included, time much better spent on other things. So we need a reasonable, predictable level of defense and other budgets. And the only way to do that, in my view, is a long-term, broad budget deal, one that gets us beyond looking at just defense and non-defense, but includes mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicare, and revenues, and considers all of those in the context of the deficit. In that deal, I would keep the Budget Control Act, or at least budget caps, because I think the process needs discipline, but I would raise them for defense and probably non-defense also, probably up to the level similar to the current Obama administration proposal, which is well above the caps levels, well, more than $30 billion above it in fiscal 18 and 20 to 30 in the years beyond. So certainly put pressure on the overall negotiations, because you'd have an up to deal with as well as needing to look at some downs. Now, you might say to yourself, I mean, this guy's got to have his head in the sand. I mean, the divisiveness of the political debate, how could we ever see such a long-term budget deal? I remain hopeful we'll get beyond this divisiveness, we'll elect somebody as president. That president, he or she, is going to have to deal with some of these issues. And I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I'm at least hopeful that we'll see a broad budget deal, because I think it's the only solution. The other issue for defense in particular the next administration has got to deal with is the future of the Overseas Contingency Operations, or OCO, budget put in place in fiscal 12 to pay the added costs of the Iraq and Afghan war. I just finished a paper, there are hard copies out there if you're interested, on the future of OCO, because although it's a technical topic, it is very important financially to the Department of Defense. So OCO has served DOD well, in my view, and the nation, I would say, in the sense that it made sure funds were available so all those actually involved in combat would have the resources they need. And I think there's probably nothing more important for the department to do financially than that. It also avoided some timing problems. The supplementals that were used before OCO were often proposed mid-year and acted late, not enough time for DOD to effectively put them in place. But OCO has been harshly criticized, and rightly, I might add, because it's increasingly been used to get around the caps. OCO is effectively not subject to the caps, so what we've done is put money into OCO that should have been in the base budget. A lot of bad things about that, and I'll, if you're interested, we can go into it more. So what do you do? What's the new administration do? The ideal thing would be to put OCO back where it was before, that use it only for wartime needs. That would probably mean moving several tens of billions of dollars out of this war budget into the base budget. Given the caps and given what I said, that they're already too low, I don't think that's practical. So regrettably, somewhat in my view, I think the administration is going to add the new one. It'll have to keep OCO, try to keep it back in its box as best they can, maybe make some small moves. But I think a practical solution is going to require that it continue. So the biggest importance, we need a broad budget deal that helps defense and other agencies get more stability and reasonable levels of budget, and this administration is going to have to do something, the next one I should say, about the future of OCO. Mike, back to you.
Well, thank you, Bob. Let me just do one follow-up question, then I'll go to Alice and Maya. I'd like to ask a little bit more about the paper itself and recommend it very strongly. I think a shorter version is being published on nationalinterest.org this week and a longer version on the Booz Allen Hamilton website. And it's a very tight read, very nice, pithy read. But if you could just summarize a couple of the key points, including out of that $60 billion OCO budget today, roughly how much, you know, has sort of gotten diverted for purposes that would not be optimal if we could imagine doing perfect budgeting. And then secondly, if you have any notional sense of what the Pentagon budget should be. I guess you said consistent with President Obama's latest request, but if you could just sort of spell that out with some rough numbers for the crowd, please.
Well, so of the $60 billion in OCO right now, there's five that's explicitly been agreed to by both sides of this debate that would be used for base funding. They just set it higher than the department thinks it needs for wartime needs. But there's a lot of other money in OCO that's at best in a gray area in terms of its contribution to wartime needs. So if you really were to skinny OCO down to be war needs only, I mean, I can't give a specific number, but I think, as I said in the paper, it'll be several tens of billions of dollars you would need to move out of OCO and put it in the base budget. Again, I don't think that's practical. The reason why you don't want base money in OCO, I mean, there's several reasons, but I think the most important one, DOD tries to do long-term planning to have a consistent five-year plan so you don't buy a bunch of stuff you can't support in the out years. OCO is a one-year budget. That's the best you can do. It's hard enough to plan wartime needs 1 year in advance. If you start putting large amounts of the base budget in OCO, you lose all of that planning, consistent planning. You lose the budget discipline that actually does happen, trade-offs within the base budget. So I think it's just a bad idea. Paul Ryan, when he was before he was Speaker of the House, said using OCO for base needs undermines the budget process. I think he's right, and to the greatest extent we can, we should avoid it.
Do you have a number you would be comfortable with for the Pentagon budget?
Yeah, overall? I mean, I would go with the Obama administration proposal. It'd be 525 in fiscal 17, maybe a little more if we get a deal out of that, and somewhere in the 540, 550 range as we look out beyond, but $20 to $30 billion above the caps.
I'm going to just add one point on this, which there's a handout, if you wish, for those of you who are here in person, which tries to summarize some of the numbers. These get confusing. Bob just gave the Pentagon or the Department of Defense base budget. So he did not include the OCO fund in that 525, and he also did not include the nuclear weapons activities of the Department of Energy. I tend to pull all those together in the, if you want to look at it in a more global sense, the National Defense Function, the 050 federal budget function, that is right now somewhere just over $600 billion. Once you've added the base budget, the OCO account, and the Department of Energy Nuclear Weapons Activities. Just to remind, that does not include the Veterans Administration, Veterans Affairs, which is another $175 billion a year in spending, roughly, which, of course, is not relevant to future defense needs. It's the debt we owe to those who have been wounded or killed and their families in previous military operations. It also does not include the Department of State's foreign assistance programs, including security assistance to countries that we may be working with in partnership. And it also does not include the Department of Homeland Security. So there are a lot of things relevant to defense in a broad sense that are not even within that 050 budget.
Which are all in non-defense discretion.
And they're all the non-defense discretionary, so they're getting squeezed. Some of the VA budget, I guess, is entitlements, and some is discretionary. So anyways, depending on what number you're looking at, what definition, in broad terms, I would say defense spending today is just over $600 billion a year, and that's considerably above the Cold War average in inflation-adjusted dollars, just for point of reference. But I still think it probably needs to go a little higher, just as Bob argued. With that context, now let's broaden a little further, and I want to ask Alice what she would think of as an adequate funding level. We'll get into the issue of the Budget Control Act and what the next Congress and President should do in just a second. But first, even though I realize you may not want to give a precise answer to this, I've been struck. I was reviewing the historical data on how much we spend on non-defense discretionary. And as a percentage of GDP, which is one good way to measure it relative to the size of the economy, in the 1960s, it started in the low 3% range, went up over 4% during the Johnson administration, went up to 5% during that liberal Richard Nixon's presidency, or at least approached 5%, and stayed up there through the 80s. Ronald Reagan never dropped it below where it is today, 3.3% of GDP. And it sort of has been in that low to mid 3 range until the Obama administration, when it got up into the low 4s in the recovery after the Great Recession. Now it's back down to about 3.4% of gross domestic product, and it's headed down under projections to 2.8%, which would be the lowest levels, I think, since the Eisenhower administration relative to the size of the economy. So that raises the big question of how much is enough for all these domestic investments, Alice, that we know are important to our long-term future.
With all due respect, Mike, that's a silly question.
Great. It's a clown question, bro.
It would be nice if one could say, here's a number, there's something sacred about this number. It's silly on both sides of the budget. I once sat down with a group of defense experts and people with stars on their shoulders, and I was the economist in the room, and they said, just give us a number for how much we should spend for defense, how much we can afford to spend for defense, and then we'll figure out how to spend it. That may have sounded reasonable to them. But what you need to spend for defense depends, obviously, on what the threats are to the country and how we think we should be dealing with them. We're spending roughly 3% of our GDP on defense right now. There was a time when, you didn't mention this when you talked about the Cold War, when we were spending 10% of our GDP, of everything we produce on defense. We perceived that we had to do that. We don't perceive that now. The domestic side of the budget is roughly the same situation. In my opinion, the two big problems facing the U.S. economy as we look ahead are we need to grow the economy faster, and there are various ways you can think of doing that, but there are some obvious ways that we're not doing. We're not modernizing our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our highways, our train systems, our sewer systems, whatever. All of those things need to be modernized and would create some jobs in the process and some not bad paying jobs in the process. So I think infrastructure is essential to looking at the future, as is the development of the skills of the workforce and staying on the forefront of science. That doesn't tell you exactly what you should spend it for. You should spend it well and on sensible projects, and we don't always do that. We don't always do it in defense either. But that's the question we ought to be talking about. But the other big threat that we aren't talking about at all, except Maya keeps trying, is that we are facing, if we go on doing what we're doing in the federal budget, we are facing a growing debt, and a debt growing quite rapidly as you look down the line. Now, why is that? That's because we have an aging population, and we are committed to Social Security benefits, but more importantly, to health benefits for people as they get older. And we have an inadequate tax system, which won't keep up with those spending needs to which we're already committed, and is pretty inefficient tax system into the bargain. So the real conversation that we ought to be having, and Bob suggested this, is how are we going to bring those two budget lines together in the future? The needs of an aging population and the revenues to support those. That's partly a question of can we deliver healthcare more efficiently, and it's partly a question of can we have a tax system which is more pro-growth but also more productive of revenue than the one we've got. I think the answer to that is yes. We had a lot of conversations about that about 5 years ago when we were in the Simpson-Bowles mode and another one that Pete Domenici and I chaired, and the president was talking to Speaker Boehner, and everybody was trying to get to the grand bargain. We didn't get there. The Budget Control Act is a bizarre piece of legislation that was supposed to get us to the grand bargain, to say we'll create some cuts in domestic and defense spending that are so unacceptable that nobody will want to do them, and therefore they will get us back to the table to do the grand bargain. Well, maybe it was a nice idea. I thought it was at the time, actually.
Nice idea.
But it didn't work. And now it's gotten us focused on the discretionary part of the budget, both defense and domestic, and discussing things like the problem of the overseas contingency operations, which is essentially a problem of how the Defense Department was able to live with unrealistic caps and cheated a bit into the bargain. And now we're trying to figure out how do we get back to something sensible. But something sensible is talk about what do we want our government to do and how do we want to pay for it over the long run. And we can't be incapable of doing that.
If I could follow up before going to Maya for her thoughts on sort of the general budget picture and what it means for our economy. I just want to make sure I understand whether you think that the current track we're on for discretionary spending is acceptable.
No.
I mean, okay.
I think it's much too low, and because of the need to invest in the future. If we just let these entitlement programs, which are mainly for older people, and I'm one of those, but they're mainly for older people in the future, if we just let them sort of escalate without thinking about how do we control this spending, then we force out investment in younger people and investment in the productivity of our economy. Nothing could be stupider than that.
You have a rough magnitude. I mean, Bob's talked about, you know, being content with Obama proposal numbers on defense. I would maybe go a little higher than that myself. So we're talking about a few tens of billions of dollars added to the annual budget. Do you have a rough order of magnitude for the domestic side?
No, I don't, because I think you need to look very carefully at proposals for what you would actually invest in, and it should grow slowly over time as you get more experience in what works. And people are talking now about bringing private sector money in through an infrastructure bank. I don't think that's a bad idea, but I don't think it's going to solve the problem. But the answer is I don't have an exact number in mind, but it's got to be a balancing act between what is productive spending on the one hand and how much can you slow the growth of spending in the future so that you're not getting onto a worse debt track than we're already on.
Do you think it's roughly, just one last clarifying point, do you think it, even though you don't want to give an exact number, that's understandable, do you think it's roughly of the same kind of magnitude we're talking about on the defense side, several tens of billions of dollars, you know, plus or minus?
I think that's largely a political question. It will be of roughly the same magnitude because that's the way the Congress thinks. And if we raise the caps on one side, we will raise them on the other. That doesn't mean it's absolutely the right number. On both sides, we need to be thinking about what should we not be doing as we invest in the things that are high priority that we aren't doing now.
So thank you. And Maya, over to you. I'd love to just get your general reactions to where we are in the conversation, but I'm also interested in sort of how you would prioritize your major economic concerns for the country looking forward.
Great. Thank you. Nice to be with all of you and nice to be with my fellow panelists. So I'm going to do what somebody does whenever they follow Alice Rivlin, which is pretty much reinforce everything Alice has just said. I'll just start by saying I love spreadsheets. I love spreadsheets so much that my favorite gift of recent years has been from a colleague who gave me a coffee mug saying, "I love spreadsheets." I assume that was custom made. I don't know how one gets that. And then my another colleague ran out and got an even larger coffee mug saying, "I love spreadsheets more." So that's how fun it is where we work in the budget world, and that's how we think of everything. But certainly, I think when you're talking about security policy, it's a great reminder that that's not actually where you start with the question of the budget. The budget should be something that's bottoms up, and I think this is what you were saying. You need to look at what your priorities are and figure out what things are important, and that's most true probably in the issue of security, where the last thing is you want is budget experts telling you what your security number should be. You want to think through your security threats, your opportunities, your long-term investments, come up with your wise security budget, and budget responsibly around that. I also think that's true for the rest of the budget, that we need to think about what our national priorities are, prioritize them, establish which ones we're willing to pursue, and then bringing in my perspective, think about how we're going to pay for those things in a fiscally responsible way. And Alice was also talking about this, but with infrastructure, right now, I think there is a broad-based agreement, and this is a good thing because there are very few broad-based agreements politically right now, but there is broad-based agreement that infrastructure is an important priority of our budget. We'll get into politics. We'll get into what's going to happen under the next president. But if there were an area that I think was sort of most likely to move first, that's probably the area. But what you're also seeing is now the kind of one-upmanship that happens in infrastructure where somebody will say, well, I think we should spend X billion more on it. And somebody else will say, I think we should spend X times two. And because it's free, because nobody's talking about how to pay for it, really, suddenly we want to spend X times 100 more in infrastructure. So again, part of the disciplining process is, what do we want to spend that money on? And evaluating it, looking at the returns, and thinking about it as part of the overall objectives of budgeting, which are growing the economy and doing a lot of important things to meet the needs of people. So I think economic growth is critically important. I also think bringing in a lot of issues of economic security, which we're hearing a whole lot about in this campaign, are very true and are very real. There are all sorts of kinds of policies we need to be thinking about that reflect the change in the economy. The pace of change in our economy right now is so much faster than we've ever seen. And we really haven't updated our social policies, our economic policies, to reflect the kinds of changes that people are going through. And I believe that will contribute to growing the economy in a fair way as well. And you also have to think about the fiscal piece of it. So where we are fiscally right now, you wouldn't really know it from the headlines. There is a whole lot of talk about how deficits have come down. though anybody who's read the recent CBO report will see that deficits are coming back up again. This was quite predictable. Deficits came down a lot after our economy started to recover. But because whenever the pressure comes off, Congress starts borrowing more and more, we actually put in place legislation last year. We had a budget that was supposed to save over 10 years $5 trillion and bring us to a balanced budget. I would argue that's probably an overly aggressive goal. And I think that's backed up by the fact that what Congress did is pass legislation that instead of saving that $5 trillion, added another trillion to the debt. You know, so when we do have budgets, we seem to ignore them. We're not in a good place fiscally. But so there's a whole lot of questions about how you're going to deal with the fiscal challenges that not only are reflected in the growing deficit, but the fact that right now our debt is at near record levels. Relative to the economy, it's the highest it's been since we came out of World War II. And what's not even that important as where we are today, because we're still lucky, we're the United States. For some reason, even when we mess up the global economy, people come here. We are still the safe haven. And that gives us an incredible luxury to get control of these fiscal problems in a timely and gradual way that actually won't derail the economy. And so we can put in place longer-term plans that would help get control of the record-level debt, of the deficits, but we haven't. And so what we have today is, looking forward, a debt that is growing faster than the economy. That's the definition of unsustainable. Interest payments that are the fastest growing part of the budget, faster even than healthcare. I mean, this is really an incredibly vulnerable situation to be in, to have your interest payments growing so much faster than other parts of the budget. And we're not borrowing for smart investments. We're not borrowing for things that will help grow the economy over time. So what I look at is the path that we're on, it's completely unsustainable. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't think about our priorities as a starting point. And I come to the frustrating conclusion that I think many people have, which is, in so many ways, this is actually a reflection of a really broken governance system right now. And we have two parties that refuse to work together, even when they have shared objectives, shared priorities. They don't even disagree on the ways to fix things as often as you would think. Sometimes I feel like there's a yes, there's an agreement in Congress, and they still call it a no and walk away from the table. But disagreements are not. There is an inability to really work together on any of these problems right now. So I guess I would summarize by saying we have taken the easy way out. The brokenness in Washington has allowed us to do things like let the sequester hit. Remember, when the sequester was built, it was created because it was a policy that was so stupid, Congress would never let it go in place. It was supposed to be an action-forcing mechanism to encourage more responsible choices on the big-picture fiscal situation. Oops, they let it go in place. And instead of fixing it, replacing it with something else, coming up with the appropriate spending levels, doing a trade where we're spending more on discretionary and getting longer-term control of our offense and, excuse me, our entitlement programs, and reforming our tax code in a way that it will be make us more competitive, help grow the economy, and raise more revenues. Instead of doing that, we did let the sequester hit. And now where we are is we're in a place where we're basically governing by default, only making choices when we have to, kind of when they're action-forcing moments, and really overly focused on short-term priorities. There is no long-term focus. And this was, I think, your point. We need to have a longer-term set of objectives, longer-term budgeting, and put in place some kind of stability so that you can make choices about security policy, about economic policy, about dealing with income insecurity, all the big challenges that we have. You can't change if you don't know if the sequester, you can't make plans if you don't know if the sequester is going to be there or not. We put these replacement deals that are basically two-year plans. There have been times we've been budgeting in 3 months at a time because Congress can't figure these things out. And when we do these deals, they often rely on huge budget gimmicks. OCO has become one of them. So we have a long list of things we need to work on. But I think the good news in all of this is if we do this, if we start to make small bits of progress, and we'll talk more about how, you start to see built-up trust, better policies, more security, more certainty, and you will see a whole lot of upside in the economy. This isn't, you're not just doing this because fiscal responsibility is the right thing to do. You do it because it helped contribute to a thriving and sustainable economy. So now we'll figure out how we get that done.
Well, that leads to my last question, which I'm going to ask each one of you to comment on. Maybe, Maya, I'll start with you. and then go to Bob, and then maybe Alice, Bryce Harper, Rivlin can clean up on the before we go to you for your questions. And it's the issue of would it be acceptable or tolerable, at least, to have a revision to the Budget Control Act by the next president and next Congress, where the caps go up a bit, we find a way to pay for them somehow, but they don't go up a huge amount. They go up by the kind of numbers Bob and I are talking on the defense side, you know, 20 to 50 billion, and that becomes the new cap, maybe roughly a 5 to 10% increase from where we are now. And then similarly on the domestic discretionary side, or whatever the number is. In other words, is it acceptable to have a revision to the Budget Control Act that keeps the basic mechanism, keeps the basic numbers in broad terms, but just pluses up the discretionary numbers? Or do we really need to just get rid of it and take advantage of this moment to have a whole new fiscal plan for the country? Probably all of us would agree the latter is better, although I want to hear how each of you react. But it gets to the question of political practicality. Would it be, whichever is better, would it be also tolerable to have a revision to the Budget Control Act if that's the best that we could get out of the next president and next Congress? So Maya, why don't I begin with you on that?
So certainly if that's the best that you can do, you want to have a revision to it. You want to plus up. I think there's no question that when both sides can't live with either defense caps or the domestic discretionary caps, these just aren't reasonable numbers. So I think plussing it up and offsetting the cost either through revenues or preferably, I think, reforms on the other areas of spending would make sense if it's not another two-year deal. I really think these short-term deals do so much damage. But what I really think is important is we need to do this bottom-up at some point. It doesn't have to be done like this over and over again, but you need to think about what the actual priorities you want to be spending money on are. And if you don't do that exercise, you never also have the chance to get rid of some of the outdated or inefficient spending, which just becomes, it lives on forever in the budget because we don't spend any time thinking through that piece of it. I personally think spending caps at the right level make sense. Now, there's no actual right level, so it's a level that people can live with. But I think the disciplining notion of a cap is useful. I think it should be paralleled on the revenue side. I don't think this is about spending only. It's about spending and revenues. But what worries me is when you have caps on the discretionary side of the budget, because think about how easy it is for a policymaker to come in and say, all we need to do is put in spending caps and live by them. They haven't actually told you a single thing they're going to cut. And that's on a very small portion of the budget, not the portion of the budget that's growing, and they made it sound simple and basically free. We're just going to put a cap in and the budget will fix itself. Budgeting is about priorities, it's about trade-offs. I think it's important when you put in caps to say what kind of policy changes you would make to live within those caps, and then you want to keep them as a disciplining process, so you have to go through your agencies and figure out what's better spending and what's less important spending. I think an arbitrary cap does more damage than not having one at all.
Thank you. Bob, you have a comment. Whether you want to get rid of the whole Budget Control Act altogether, or could you live with a revision?
I would keep the caps, whether it's part of the Budget Control Act or another act. I agree with Maya. You need that disciplining process. The effort to decide, in the case of defense, what you want to spend should indeed be a bottom-up. In fact, it is at least partially a bottom-up now. I mean, as I think many of you participated in this process, the president kind of picks a number at the beginning of the planning process and revises it late in the planning process at defense. But the in between, there's a great deal of bottom-up effort, which is threat-based as best one can. There's never a simple calculus that says a certain threat yields a particular number, so the arguments go on. But I think there is a bottom-up process absolutely important and Mike, your book tries to look at it in broad terms. But in the end, yes, I'd keep a cap because I think that discipline is important. Whether we need caps, we also at least need more debate outside of the discretionary portion of the budget. I don't know, maybe I can set up Alice here by quoting an idea that she had that I thought was a very good one, which is Congress ought to start appropriating for the entitlement portions of the budget. Right now, they're on automatic pilot, and at least that would force them to debate what are growing portions of the budget. So, yes, we need caps, but we need them higher in the case of the discretionary spending, and we need to do something analogous in the non-defense entitlement portions of the budget.
Thank you. Alice.
I think revising the Budget Control Act depends, of course, what you mean, but revising the Budget Control Act is a mistake because the act was a mistake. It does not relate to the problem of the whole budget. What you need is to scrap the attention that is being paid to discretionary spending, which is, after all, less than a third of the budget. Not that I'm against caps, but the notion of revising the Budget Control Act just keeps the focus on this one-third of the budget, which is not where the focus ought to be. It is not what is driving the long-term increase in debt. I think we're all saying the same thing here, but I wouldn't revise the BCA. I would repeal it and replace it with a broader budget process that forces the Congress to think ahead and several decades ahead about what are we going to do to put Social Security back on a firm basis. That's not a very hard problem, but it needs to be done. What are we going to do to control the costs of Medicare and Medicaid so that we can make a decision every once in a while about what we want to do on them? That is not to say we want to punish old people. We want to think through what is the appropriate amount to spend, and the way to do that is to say, here's what we want to spend, and we're going to review it in 5 years, and if we're off the track, then we have a decision to make about what to do. Similarly, with the tax code and tax expenditures, we spend an enormous amount in the tax code on things like housing and other things that we aren't spending terribly well, and we never get a chance to review it. So I would not just revise the BCA. I would say repeal it and put back something that deals with entitlements or so-called mandatory spending, the tax code, including tax expenditures, and incidentally also caps discretionary spending.
I guess I do have one last follow-up for you before going, and probably some of you would have a similar kind of question, I'm guessing, but I wonder, Alice, if the only counter-argument that I can think of to what you just said is that you're now requiring reform in a number of politically contentious areas, and if you link everything together such that you don't have a new bill until you get agreement on everything, do we really want to keep the Budget Control Act until a Republican House and Hillary Clinton can agree on tax reform? Because somebody's going to have to buckle, right? I mean, because Democrats for a long time have wanted to raise rates, at least on the wealthy. Republicans traditionally don't. And so are you setting yourself up for paralysis?
Oh, that's how we got where we are. We've had paralysis for quite a long time. And paralysis is leading us in the wrong direction. So, sure, I mean, it's probably a total breakdown in any budget consideration of anything would be worse than just reenacting the Budget Control Act, but not much worse.
Very good. Okay, well, I think we'll take two questions at a time. Please wait for a microphone and identify yourself when you get it. If you like, you can pose the question to one person specifically or to the panel. I'll start with David Sedney, who's right in the middle. I think I saw your hand move. Yes, and about in the seventh row, the very nice tie, in case you're having a hard time finding. There are a lot of great ties in the audience, but...
Bob, you mentioned OCO for Department of Defense. Of course, the Department of State also has about $14 billion in the OCO request this year. And I wondered if you had any comments about the use of OCO for state as well as a defense. The second question, again, for the entire panel, for you as well. You recounted the use of OCO before that, the use of supplementals. In the first couple years in Afghanistan, we just reprogrammed money. But what to me is shown repeatedly, we don't have a mechanism for dealing with unanticipated major contingencies. And as you said, the Department of Defense likes to plan ahead, likes to plan many years ahead. But Afghanistan in 2001, Iraq, all these other things, they don't fit into the budget planning. How do we, do you have ideas on how we could handle those more effectively than we do now? And then finally, one last comment. Why don't we just, instead of automatic budget cuts, have automatic tax increases if the budget can't be balanced? Thank you.
And let's do one more, and then we'll go to the panel. Okay, we'll start here in the front row, and then I'll have a second round.
Larry Checo with Accountability Central. I'd like to come at this from just a little bit of a different angle with revenues. I did a little research recently on the IRS, and they have come out with a report that says a combination of unreported income and uncollected income from 2006 to 2010 every year averages about $400 billion. That's a huge amount of money when you're talking about $30 billion to $50 billion and raising the caps. A lot of that is because of the unfairness in the tax code, and I think that is something that needs to be addressed. But the other thing that's going to make the problem even more dire is the fact that the IRS budget has been cut by about 17%. So it's not only the perception of unfairness, it's the perception of unenforced audits. You know, I mean, it's a crapshoot. And the odds are more in your favor every year as long as they keep cutting the IRS budget. So I think if we look at it from a revenue income position, it might be a little, we might not be having the situation we're in now.
Thank you. So we'll start with Bob and then just work down the panel.
So OCO and state, it's a lot smaller than defense, but as a percentage of state's budget is much larger. So in some ways, it's much more important to state. I think they've had some of the same issues. I'm less familiar with the details as defense does in terms of use for non-war needs, but I think the Department of State needs OCO just as the department needs OCO to be sure that it can finance wartime needs, and I suspect there'd be the same practical problems of getting rid of it, that is, the State Department budget would have a great deal of difficulty in absorbing those amounts. So I think we need to keep OCO for state. In general, I'd say we're probably spending not enough money on the Department of State and too much on defense, not enough money on trying to prevent war and negotiate, and too much getting ready for it and fighting when we have to. In terms of unanticipated needs, David, I mean, if it really occurs in the middle of a year, you don't have much choice but to move to an emergency supplemental. And Congress is quite good when something serious happens. I mean, 9/11 certainly is an example. They made money available very quickly, days in that case. But I think the OCO mechanism should be maintained. I mean, it's gotten a bad name because it's been misused. But in fact, as I said earlier, it has served the department well because it has allowed the department to make sure that the people in combat have the resources they need, and that's got to be critical. So I think we should keep OCO for both state and the Department of Defense. Try to restrain its use to just things that are directly related to wartime requirements. And for truly unanticipated needs, midterm, mid of a year, we'll have to use emergency supplementals.
Okay, I'm going to make a quick comment on OCO, which may or may not be right. So if it's wrong, you need to correct me. But I think given where spending that could actually legitimately fall into OCO is going, it may well increase in the coming years. And so there may be more of funds sort of spent on ISIS or other things that could go into OCO. And if that happens, it's interestingly going to actually put some of the pressure on, assuming OCO doesn't grow, it's going to actually put pressure back onto the caps because a lot of the things that have been being pushed into OCO may not be able to. So I just wonder where that's headed. Contingency budgeting, I think, is a critically important thing, and I'll completely oversimplify, but anybody who runs an organization thinks about these things, you always think about how you want to have flexibility in your budget so that as either opportunities or threats come along, you can meet them. We still don't do that well enough at all in terms of our budget, and you can see that from fights that are going on right now, whether it's natural disasters, when it's healthcare threats, when it's national security threats. We need to do a better and more systematic approach of building into our budget crisis funds, funds for things that you don't expect, emergency funds, that are a certain share of your budget, and you know that these are the likely costs that will come. You just don't know where they are, and you have that, and you have that paid for. Because one of the things that concerns me, again, from my fiscal responsibility mantle, is it shouldn't just be an excuse to not pay for something just because it's important. This happens all the time. Something, there is a huge emergency. It is critically important that we get funding to it. That does, we should not have a budget that's built so we don't actually pay for it and borrow it. Instead, we should have budgeted resources for those emergencies ahead of time. On your question about revenues, I think it's an excellent question because when we created the sequester, there was a judgment call that was made, and it was because you were going to include in the sequester across-the-board cuts both to defense and domestic discretionary, both political sides of the aisle would not want that to happen. Presumably, Republicans would be worried about defense cuts, Democrats worried about domestic discretionary, to overgeneralize. And so they didn't put revenues into the sequester, I assume because it was too hard a negotiation to include them. I think that was a mistake. We did an internal commission at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget a number of years ago, and we had a plan where you would have debt targets, targets that you have to get to in the budget so that your debt is coming down relative to the economy. And if you failed to get there, there would be across-the-board spending cuts and revenue increases. And it was many of the Republicans who were part of this commission who said, you need to have the revenue increases, because that's what our side of the aisle is not going to be able to tolerate. That will force us to go to the table. We won't let these sequesters hit. But the lessons of sequesters or triggers is that there's two models. There's the one that you fill it with really bad policies, and you assume that they're so bad, lawmakers won't let them go in place. Again, oops, we've learned that we don't actually know how to make them bad enough because we do let them go in place. So the other possibility is when you build sequesters or triggers, do you actually maybe build ones that are pretty decent policies, so if they went into place? So you think about smart triggers, where if government didn't act and the trigger went into place, you had, for instance, thoughtful reforms to Social Security that would increase the payroll tax cap and look at how you change benefits in a progressive way that would help make the system headed back toward solvency. So if we're going to let those dumb triggers go in place, it might be better to build smart triggers instead.
Please.
I agree with all of that. Back to unforeseen emergencies, I think there has been a bit of progress in budgeting for things like forest fires and floods that happen, and you ought to be able to budget for a significant contingency fund that allows you to spend when those things happen, and gets reconsidered every once in a while, but avoids, as Maya said, the emergency legislation to which everybody attaches their favorite little spending program and calls it an emergency. But as Bob said, if you have Pearl Harbor or you have 9/11, you're going to have to do something really, really special. On the revenue side, yes, I think if we're going to have sequesters, revenue should be in them. But it comes back to my basic point. We shouldn't be budgeting with gimmicky stuff that forces us to do what we ought to be doing anyway. Namely, here are some big problems. Let's sit down together, we the Republicans and we the Democrats, and try to figure out what to do. And that's what we're not doing. We're not talking in bipartisan groups on the Hill and between the Hill and the White House on how to solve the problems that we have. And until we start doing that, all of these gimmicks are going to be just unfortunate ways of coping with something we're not doing.
Mike. None of us answered the tax gap question as well.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. if the IRS had more money to do audits, we would be collecting more taxes. If HHS had more money to do audits of the Medicare and Medicaid programs, there would be less Medicaid fraud. And that's not trivial either. It shocks me that doctors are willing to put in false bills, but there are places where they are. And they collect a lot of money, and then nobody goes after them because the budgets are too constrained. So, yes, we ought to enforce rectitude on all fronts.
Mike, just briefly, and then to pick up on Alice's point, DOD does have some contingency money appropriated ahead of time for humanitarian disasters in particular, $100 million, and Congress kind of monitors if it gets spent, they'll add to it. If it doesn't, they'll maybe not as appropriate as much. So there is some flexibility. And although I never would have said that when I was a DOD comptroller, for relatively smaller contingencies in a budget of $500 billion with an operating day-to-day operating budget of $200 billion, you can move money around to take place. Things, Libya is a good example. We spent a couple hundred million dollars in operating costs. We screamed like stuck pigs for a supplemental. The White House was totally unwilling to do it because they didn't want everything attached to it. And we found a way to find the money. So for smaller items, the size of the department's budget gives it some flexibility, although once again, I would have disavowed that statement aggressively as a comptroller.
Let's have a couple more in this round. Go to these two gentlemen here.
Thank you very much. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, and it's only been 43 years since I took a PhD in economics. I want to congratulate Dr. O'Hanlon for his article in Foreign Affairs. And I'd like to ask any of the panelists about inequality. Inequality has grown significantly in our economy in the last two decades. And if anyone would like to comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Then take another.
Thank you. John Harper with National Defense Magazine. My question is for Michael and whoever else on the panel wants to weigh in. But based on what the presidential candidates have said so far, what level of defense spending might we expect from a Clinton administration versus a Trump administration, and how might that affect the defense industrial base?
I guess I'll start, and we can work down the other way this time. Thank you. I should acknowledge, first of all, in the article that I had a co-author named Dave Petraeus, which was nice to pick up a friend like that. And one of the things that both he and I feel strongly about is that the Army's been cut enough. Neither one of us argued in that article or in my monograph for a huge Army, but the Army today is smaller than it was in the 1990s. And so just in very broad terms, active duty Army was 800,000 or so under Ronald Reagan. It was cut to about 500,000 under the Clinton administration. And then it went up a bit during the wars of the 2000s, but now it's down, headed to 450,000 active duty and about 500,000 Guard and Reserve combined. So the whole Army together is almost 1 million, but that's still substantially less, obviously, than the Cold War and even a bit less than in the 1990s. That's just one area where we see an argument for modest increases in spending. By the way, just so you don't think that Petraeus was just trying to beef up his old service, much of the article is about the what he himself coined the phrase, the half revolution in air power and intelligence, which he really attributes for a lot of the successes we've had in many of the commando operations and other things in recent years. On the issue of Trump versus Clinton and defense spending, I don't know, you know, there are a lot of important differences between those two candidates. I'm not sure this is one of them. I don't know that there is any great specificity in either candidate's defense platform. I think both would like to argue that they're improving the military. Trump's called it a disgrace. I think he's used rhetoric that doesn't really hold up. But he's, in fairness to Trump, and I don't usually use that phrase, but in fairness to Trump, it's a time-honored tradition to identify specific problems with the military and exaggerate them or at least really emphasize them in a political campaign. And there can sometimes even be good that comes from that because you do get people to focus acutely and keenly on the specific shortfalls that always exist, even if you have a generally well-resourced military. So when I put all that together, I would expect either one of those two potential presidents to spend a bit more than we're spending now, to advocate a military a bit larger and more expensive than the one President Obama favors, and therefore, you know, in very broad terms, to be roughly consistent with the number I'm putting out there of a $650 billion a year total national defense budget. But that's just a guess, because as you know, this campaign is not producing quite as many specifics on every policy issue as we sometimes get. And with that, I'll turn things to Alice.
Let me speak to the inequality point, which is an extremely important point, and probably we all should have emphasized earlier. We have had, over quite a long period, very serious increases in inequality, which is partly at the top, and that a lot of attention has been paid there to the 1%, which is I think serious overcompensation of high corporate executives and over compensation of the financial sector. Some of that's fixable in the tax code. Some of it's quite hard to fix. But the much more important problem is what's happening at the bottom. It's average wages falling behind, and particularly for people with limited skills and education. That's not easy to fix, but it's fixable. I mean, we know a lot of things that will help. We can invest in the skills and skills of everybody, but differentially in those who have low skill and are coming out of either difficult circumstances or have lost jobs and as the economy changes. And we shouldn't slow down change. I mean, the idea that we can stop the world and get off globalization and do something, I'm not sure what, is fanciful. We need to be managing change better, and that's managing the people, finding opportunities for people who are displaced either by trade or by technological change or by anything else that can give them more productive futures.
Okay, first to the question about the candidates. One of the things that we've done at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is we've done a whole tally that's looked at all of the candidates' proposals and how they would affect the national debt. It's called Promises and Price Tags, and for anybody who's interested, I encourage you to go to our website and look at it. I won't give away the punchline, but I will just say we're still looking for somebody who has a plan to deal with the debt because it doesn't exist yet. But there's some pretty significant differences between what we found. On the area of defense, there just isn't the specificity at all to be able to figure out what would happen to the budget either under either a President Trump or President Clinton. Trump has made comments that both have said we need to spend more to strengthen our military and we need to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse or waste in the budget. Both can be true, actually, and I think it's actually an important thing about budgeting that there are within the silos of budgeting, there's probably every area where you should be spending more in some places and less in others. But there have not been any specifics, really, that has allowed us to come up with a score or a cost. Likewise, what Hillary Clinton has said is that she would like to get rid of the sequester and she would like to pay for it, but she has not said that she would get rid of it and she has not talked about how she would pay for it. So we do high, medium, and low estimates, and sometimes we assume she would get rid of the sequester, and sometimes we don't, since she hasn't figured out how to pay for it but said she would need to. Both of those are plans that need the details need to be filled out. On the really important issue of income inequality, I think this may turn out to be one of the most, I do believe it will be turn out to be one of the most important issues of our time. And a lot of times when you think about issues, economic issues affecting individuals, there are a lot of different things that people talk about. They will talk about poverty, economic mobility, economic security, economic opportunity, and income inequality. And for some reason, income inequality is the one that people get most nervous about. And a lot of times in conversations, you'll hear somebody say, no, it's not about income inequality, it's about mobility. But I actually think it's gotten bad enough to the point where it really is about income inequality as well as all of those other things. And they each actually have, Alice was saying this, different policies that you need to meet those different objectives. But one of the problems that income inequality, I think, is leading to in this country is that we're supposed to have an economic system that's based on merit and a political system that's completely separate from your economic situation. And I worry that you're seeing cracks in both of those, where in a very fast-paced, changing economy, where it takes money to make money, income inequalities are exacerbating, and that's one of the problems. And the second problem is that you're seeing it influence the political sector more than it used to and in new ways, so that you're seeing that the consolidation of income and wealth is leading to consolidation of power. And so I think these are huge structural issues in our country that go to the core sort of foundations of fairness and how we've built these systems. And I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of what we're going to do about them.
So we certainly don't know what either side would spend. As Maya and others have said, they haven't been specific. Having watched defense budgets now for more than four decades, my sense is the Republicans would start a little higher. And in the debate between threats and concerns about deficit and other spending priorities come down, the Democrats tend to go the other way. I mean, we saw in the Reagan era, we saw, I think, that happen. He started high. Congress actually brought down his level of spending some. The Democrats tend to start low, and as the debate over threats and concerns to come up a bit, and I think you've seen that to some extent in this administration, so I would guess they'll end up roughly at similar places, and then I would agree with Mike, given the threats to security right now, it'll be slightly higher than where we are now.
Okay, so let's do another round. I want to make sure I use the back of the room's expertise here as well, but we'll start here in the front, in the second row. And then I promise, guys, in the third and fifth rows, I'll come back to you. But yeah, right here, Ben. And then, but I'm still looking for a hand in the back. So yes, sir, be the second one this round.
I'm Hank Gaffney, 54 years on defense. One thing that I haven't heard is when talking about debt, I read all the Krugman, Summers, et cetera, articles. And, of course, we're entering a period of secular stagnation, or deep into it, rather, and don't really know the way out. But at the same time, interest rates, like 1.37% on bonds, and it looks like it's going to be that way for a long time. I heard Ben Bernanke in one of these Brookings sessions a couple of months ago note that the national debt, publicly held debt, will increase from 74% to 77% over the next 10 years. I'm not sure quite what the big problem with debt is.
And then we'll do one more question.
Thanks. Charlie Clark, reporter with Government Executive. A question for Mr. Hale. Do the Pentagon lobbyists and planners, when they meet with the White House, do they restrict themselves to what the defense budget ought to be, or do they take note of the fact that it's linked to the domestic spending and the revenue question, and is it kosher for them to get into that at all?
Why don't we start with Maya and then Alice on the debt, and then we'll have Bob take the last question.
Okay. Yes, you're hearing a whole lot right now about interest rates are so low, and by God, we should be borrowing a lot more. And no surprise, everybody wants to borrow for things that they actually wanted to borrow for before, even when interest rates were high. So it's sort of what happens, like when there's emergencies, when there are other things, everybody changes the story for why they want to do what they already wanted to do. That's not to dismiss this argument, because I think there is some merit to it and there's some importance to it. But beware people selling free lunches, because there rarely are free lunches when it comes to budgeting in the economy. There's smarter things that we can do. Actually, we're doing so many dumb things. There's a lot of smarter things we can do. But we cannot fix all our problems without actually tackling the basic trade-offs that comes from budgeting. If you want to do something, you should pay for it. What I do think we have on our side, because rates are so low, and again, because we're still the safe haven, is the ability not to worry about our record debt levels today, not to look at our budget and say, we need to cut spending and raise taxes immediately, but to say we still have space in our economy to deal with the fact that growth is not what it could and should be, and put in place policies that will help gin up growth now at the same time that we put in place medium and long-term plan to get our debt back down. So part of a comprehensive economic growth policy is what things will help grow the economy. One of those things is not borrowing too much. We have seen that, or there's arguments that are strong and compelling that excessively high levels of debt slow economic growth. So you want to put your plan, your economy on a trajectory to get the debt growing slower than the economy. You can do those together, right? So you can put in place more spending, tax cuts if you think that's the right thing in the short term, as long as they're offset over the longer term. I think the bigger issue is, what do you spend money on? Right now, by far the vast majority of our budget is spent on consumption, not on investment. I think the argument you hear this mainly about infrastructure, let's borrow more for infrastructure, is really an argument of, let's spend more on things that will grow the economy. And infrastructure is particularly desirable because it has long-term growth effects and short-term job creation. And as I think Alice said, jobs that tend to have good wages. But the problem with the argument that rates are so low, we can just borrow and, you know, hundreds of billions more on all sorts of investment spending, is we've been borrowing so much for consumption. We've borrowed so much already for things we shouldn't have borrowed for, that we've kind of used up a lot of that borrowing space. If we had a budget where we paid for the consumption items, but we borrowed for the things that were actual investment, that would be a sensible budget. But what's not as sensible is to borrow for all your consumption and then to say, well, the rest is investment, so I'm going to borrow for that too. If you've already borrowed for your big spending splurge, you know, then it's hard to say, I have so much room to borrow for college if you already borrowed for your major shopping trips for years and years. The final thing I would just kind of encourage people who think about this issue, the Congressional Budget Office came out with a really good report that showed spending on infrastructure is a good place to make investments, but spending on infrastructure would help grow the economy more if it's paid for over a reasonable amount of time. So it's just like tax cuts don't actually pay for themselves. Borrowing for infrastructure doesn't actually pay for itself. You do need to find a way to pay for those things. But because the rates are low, we have a longer time period over which to pay for it.
Let me address the question, what's wrong with the debt? Why shouldn't we just have lots and lots of debt? I think two things. One is you do have to pay interest on it. The amount dedicated to debt service is rising rapidly, as Maya said very early. But it's not huge because interest rates at the moment are so low. I don't think we can count on that forever. And if you think about what a very large debt with moderate interest rates as we have experienced in the past, does to your federal budget, you have to pay the interest on the debt. You have to pay that off the top. And that means that you can't spend as much for all the other things you need to do, including defense. So that's a big risk. It isn't an imminent risk, but it is definitely a risk. The other is, who owns this debt? Way back at the end of World War II, we actually had a larger debt in relation to our GDP than we have now, but we owed it all to ourselves. Now, the holders of U.S. government debt are all around the world and are very heavily other governments and financial institutions in other places. The Chinese, the oil-rich countries, and some others. That's a vulnerable position to be in. But I think the problem with the Paul Krugman argument is that it's a very one-sided argument. I agree with him that we ought to be spending a lot more on investments that will grow the economy. But I think we can do that at the same time that we rein in the longer run expenditures on consumption, primarily for the elderly. That's not meaning they should have less, but that it shouldn't be growing as fast as it is and not growing faster than the revenues. And we've got to fix our tax system. So Paul's a very, very smart man, but he thinks that you can only concentrate on one thing at a time, and the thing to concentrate on right now is growing the economy and investing. I don't think that's right. I think we have to do both at the same time.
Before going to Bob, could I follow up and putting on my cap as amateur economist to ask you, but I've gotten this from reading you, Alice, isn't there even a third argument, which is if we have another economic downturn and we're starting at 75% debt, our ability to then get through that downturn without running the risk of losing a lot of foreign investment and driving the debt up to preposterously high levels is sacrificed?
Yes. I mean, look at what happened in 2008. We went into the financial crisis with debt levels that were quite moderate, 35, under 40% of our GDP. And just because of the recession, we ended up in the 70s. We can't do that again.
And just to add on to that, because the number that you said was that the debt was going to grow to 77% in 10 years. It would grow to 87% of GDP over the next 10 years. If we do nothing right now from the newest CBO numbers, we are on track to borrow $8.5 trillion over the next 10 years, and the debt will go up more than 10% of GDP. And that's before you have a lot of unpaid-for priorities. And I think the point that Mike brought in addition to Alice's too, is that this is about fiscal flexibility. We were able to deal with 2008 because our debt was in such a healthy place. If the business cycle is a normal length, we are closer to the next downturn than the last downturn. And we are not in good shape to go forward into that one with our debt where it is already.
Thank you.
Jared Bernstein said the CBO has exaggerated the increases in interest rates?
Ben Bernanke says that too, not about the CBO particularly, but about everybody's projections of interest rates. Interest rate projections have come down. The other piece of good news is that healthcare spending increases have come down. So we're not in as dire a situation as we were 6 years ago. But as Maya says, we have a little more time to fix it. But that doesn't mean we should ignore it.
Well, and I think in the newest CBO report, interest rates were projected to be lower. That made the deficit slightly lower. But the sad news was that was a reflection of more dismal projections about the economy going forward. So lower interest rates isn't necessarily a good thing. It's a good thing sort of in the immediate budget effects, but it's a bad thing when the fact is it's reflecting that we don't have enough confidence that we're growing the economy the way we should be. And regardless of interest rates, it's this being prepared to deal with the next economic downturn is still a very real risk that many people have been identifying recently.
Bob, so Pentagon officials talking to the White House and others about non-defense. First off, please don't use the word lobbyists with Pentagon officials. It's illegal for federal employees. But for the most part, to answer your question, I think they restrict themselves to discussing the defense budget. There have been some notable exceptions. Bob Gates spoke out publicly and to members of Congress about a need for higher budgets in the State Department. But I think for the most part, they restrict themselves. It doesn't mean there isn't a debate over the broader trade-offs. The Office of Management and Budget, certainly part of its job is to lay out for the president and senior advisors alternatives that look at both defense and non-defense as well as other federal spending. And, of course, the president's political advisors would certainly be discussing it. But I think Pentagon officials generally restrict themselves to defense.
I'm going to add one footnote on that. Ben Bernanke's name has already been mentioned a couple of times today, and last year we held an event in August with Ben Bernanke, and defense and the economy was the theme. And he and Mark Muro, our colleague in Metropolitan Studies, made the excellent point that for much of the Cold War, when defense spending was 6 to 10% of GDP, defense almost provided a default national science and investment strategy because we were putting so much money into research and development. We didn't think of it as trying to build our future domestic economy per se, and Americans historically haven't wanted to have an industrial policy or to pick winners or use your favorite phrase, but implicitly we put a lot of money into our long-term economic foundations, which spilled over into our domestic economy through the defense sector. But if defense is only 3% of GDP, you're not getting the same magnitude of effects today, and you may have to think harder about whether your science and infrastructure investment strategies therefore deserve more attention and maybe even more resources directly focused on them because they're not getting it through spillover out of the defense sector the way they were before. I don't want to put words in Ben or Mark's mouth per se, but that was a theme of the conversation for a while. So we'll go back to the front, and the gentleman here in the third row and then in the fifth, please.
My name is Eddie Eiches, and I'm a union officer. And I think that the real problem really is getting stuff through Congress. And even when you all talk about infrastructure, there was a story today on NPR about gas consumption being the highest ever because prices are so low and no one's willing to increase the gas tax. The Budget Control Act, at least from perspective of inequality and domestic spending, was set up really to protect the domestic discretionary budget. And that's why on some level, until Congress is responsible, we still have to have a Budget Control Act. As to OCO, I mean, I would suggest, as was said earlier, we'd want that to be as low as possible to increase the ceiling for the Budget Control Act to the extent that we still have the Budget Control Act so we can increase domestic discretionary spending.
Thank you.
Tom Oakley, National Economist Club. Michael, you've talked before about reforms and Alice Rivlin as well, and the armed services, medical, retirement, accounts like that that would make the Army, the Navy, Air Force, Marines more efficient. Is there a trigger to induce that? I mean, clearly now at the current budget levels, not investing in R&D is a product of perhaps investing too much in retirement or other forms of non-efficient returns on capital. I'd love to get your view on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe we'll take one more since the first was an eloquent comment more than a question. So right here. Yes, please.
Tom Olson. A lot of European countries spend a lot less money on education, on defense, and on medical care, and they seem to be they seem to have more equality and some would say better life styles than America does. So what would happen if we started to spend a lot less on education, medical care, and defense? Wouldn't our economies suffer from that?
So I guess we can work down the row, and hopefully we'll have time for one more round as well. Very briefly, and Bob Hale's going to want to comment, I'm sure, on your question as well, because he saw a number of proposals by the Pentagon to the Congress to make modest reforms in personnel accounts, and they often didn't go very far, often like the base closure proposal didn't go very far. And obviously, there are a number of reasons for that, some of them very valid, that we realized we were asking a lot of our men and women in uniform, and therefore, unless you could really project a commitment to sustain good compensation, people could very easily get nervous that we weren't being fair to them. I think the Obama administration was very fair to them, to be clear, but the politics, obviously, can be difficult. On retirement reform in the military, most people here probably know that we have the old-fashioned system of you do 20 years, you get a pretty nice pension. If you do 19 and a half years or less, you get zip. I don't think that's fair. So my first concern about military retirement is equity and fairness more than saving money. There have been commissions that have looked for ways to save money, recognizing that, you know, retired officers in particular make a pretty nice pension. Many of them come out in their late 40s or early mid-40s, and they're very healthy and have good second careers. And there probably is room to rethink some of those officer pensions. But I think the first order of business is to use the savings to give at least a modest 401k-like benefit to the person who did 8 years and then got out and may not have as good of an economic path forward. So I've become a little more, I've reoriented my thinking a little bit on that one. On medical, I do think you could probably save a little bit. I think maybe a little higher copayment. But again, Bob's seen the difficulty of getting even modest proposals through the Congress. And in my overall argument, looking at nuclear weapons modernization, where I'd be a little more parsimonious and economical than the Pentagon, looking at a couple of tactical aircraft programs where I'd make some changes and reforms, I think if you put a number of these things together and you get base closures, you might be able ultimately to get several billion dollars a year in savings that are sustainable and stay at that level. You're going to do very, very well ever to approach $10 billion in the aggregate of all of those reforms, which is why I still favor a modest real increase in the defense budget.
I would subscribe to the importance of the pension reform, and also I think there are savings and improved care to be had in reforms to the dependents health care and retiree health care. Let me come to the question about other countries, because I think it's complicated. Yes, much of Europe spends a lot less on defense. That's because they got us to defend them, and they know it. So I don't think that one counts. They do spend less per person on health care, but they spend more in general on social services, children's allowances, early childhood education, and social supports, which is part of why I think they have less inequality. Why do we spend so much on health care and never seem to be able to have a satisfactory system? It's for a lot of different reasons. We have this complex system with very high administrative costs, and we compensate our health professionals extremely well. Especially specialists, and we use more specialists. And there are other reasons, but it's a complicated question. And just saying, well, if we spent less, we'd have more equality, but would it hurt our economy? Not clear one way or the other.
So I think actually I'd come at the reforms in a different way. I think this administration has had some success, as past ones have. For example, the Congress did pass a modest reform in the military retirement system that provides a 401k-like provision for those with less than 20 and slightly reduces the pensions or modestly reduces the pensions for those with 20 and more. But a lot of other things, restructuring co-pays in pharmacy, for example, so that you get people to use generic and mail order more. Congress went further and actually mandated the use of mail order. And I could go through a number of lists. That DOD needs to continue that. They owe it to themselves because they need the money. They owe it to the public because there are options for further reform. And hopefully Congress will cooperate. And, you know, the history is if you keep trying, they will. I think we'll get BRAC legislation eventually, even though they desperately don't want it because of the job effects. I think eventually they're running out of reasons to say no, and I think we'll see it if the next president and Secretary of Defense push it. So, yes, there has been some reform, and it needs to continue.
Okay, one last round, and then we'll wrap up. So we'll go with the gentleman in the far back who's been waiting patiently, and then my... women friends in the room really going to make me call only on men. This is not going to go over well. Even though I've got some very distinguished women, obviously, with me on the panel. So we got one back there, and I guess going once, going twice, we'll go to these two gentlemen up here with really quick questions, and then we'll be answering everybody's questions.
One really technical question. When I think on debt structuring in the United States, we did away with the 30-year bond or treasury debt some years ago. With interest rates this low, would it be a good thing to bring that back? And my second question is, who's everybody's Secretary of Defense nominee for the two candidates?
I'm going to let you answer that, Mike.
Dave Rabinowitz, I have a very quick question. It's been mentioned several times that we need to revise the tax system. Can we get some specifics?
I'm Jack Kropansky, unaffiliated. I was just wondering how unified should the budget be, especially with entitlements, and should there be a lot more and larger contingency funds? And also, like with infrastructure, with DOD, if you want to put a investment in place, you have downstream maintenance and replacement costs that aren't immediately budgeted.
Bob, do you want to start, and then we'll just work down?
Well, in terms of, I'm going to pass on the next Secretary of Defense. Let's get through the election. In terms of the unification of the budget, I mean, I'll give the same answer I did before. I think the departments probably need to be arguing for their own. The president needs to hear alternative views of what the departments need. But he or she has got to depend on places like the Office of Management and Budget to bring alternative views of the balance. And I think within reason that process works well. Alice headed OMB, so she can take exception if she wants. But certainly in the case of defense, non-defense, there were lots. OMB was free with their thoughts on alternatives for the president, and I think that's as it should be.
I'm going to address your tax question. Where to start? There's so many things we could do to reform our tax code. But the way I think about tax reform is the basic parameters of broaden the base, lower the rate, and along with lowering the rate, take some of that money to close the budget deficit. But the tax base is Swiss cheese. We have so many expenditures, credits, exclusions, deductions, and they're incredibly popular. It's really easy to talk about them and say, oh, yes, we need to broaden the tax base. But then when you say to somebody, that means the home mortgage interest deduction. Oh, no, it's not so popular anymore. But there is significantly over $1 trillion in lost revenue a year. That is a lot of money that we could make up by getting rid of a bunch of those tax breaks that they get no oversight. They're very regressive. They pay people to do things they'd be doing anyhow. They're not structured in ways that are thoughtful, and we never go back and look over them. So I would do as much as possible to broaden that base. It's very difficult to do. I came up with, Marty Feldstein and I and Dan Feinberg came up with a plan that said if you can't go through them one by one and really make reforms, at least you could think about capping them. So you limit how much in tax breaks relative to your income somebody could take every year. That way you wouldn't have to pick the winners and losers of the tax breaks, but we would say they can only be X amount of your income or X amount in terms of dollars. I am not a huge fan of the corporate income tax. I think it doesn't work very well in a globalized economy where capital is so mobile. So while I think there are a lot of things we have to do to reform the corporate income tax, I'm actually more interested in thinking about big replacement taxes and new revenue sources that this country needs. One I've always loved is the progressive consumption tax. I think taxing more of what you don't want instead of what you do want is a smart thing. I think consumption taxes can make sense, but they're very regressive. So progressive consumption taxes, which are difficult to administer and create, but are very desirable in terms of design. And I'm certainly a fan of a carbon tax. I think it's long overdue in this country. So I think there are a lot of places we could go. The goal should be to increase our competitiveness, the efficiency of the tax code, taxing the things that we want to be taxing, and to raise revenue.
I agree with that. Let me just underline a couple of points. One is, the tax base is Swiss cheese, and there are a few egregious things that ought to be fixed, like calling the income of hedge fund managers carried interest, and somehow it's something that some kind of expense that shouldn't be taxed. That's ridiculous. It would help a little bit on the inequality problem. But there are actually only a few deductions that make a lot of difference, deductions, exclusions. One of them Maya's already mentioned is the home mortgage deduction. And it is a deduction, not a credit, so that the higher your income and the larger your mortgage, the more it benefits you. Now, that's ridiculous. We just went through a period in which we grossly overbuilt high-end housing, in part because we subsidized it so much through the tax code. It doesn't mean we shouldn't encourage home ownership, but you could convert the home mortgage deduction to a credit against tax and design it so that it wasn't quite so costly, and it benefited middle-income people more and high-income people less. Now, you have to phase it in and all that stuff, but that's a very good idea. The other big one is the exclusion of your employer's health benefits from your income, which is a big incentive to say, I want generous health insurance from my employer because it's not taxed, and I'd rather have that than wages. And that's very unfortunate because it leads to overconsumption of health care. And it the people who benefit from that are the same people, high earners and particularly people who work for big corporations. So gradually phasing out that exclusion would make a lot of sense.
And as I thank my co-panelists or the speakers today and thank all of you for being here and for your excellent questions, I'll briefly answer this last question about who might be Secretary of Defense. I don't.
Are you a candidate?
No, but I'm going to come to somebody else on this stage who might be, or at least who I think should be. But I don't know who Donald Trump would choose, and so I won't go there. But I do think that people, and in seriousness, people hear a lot, or talk a lot about Undersecretary of Defense Michelle Flournoy as a person who would be the first woman Secretary of Defense in American history. I'll just take this moment, since I was asked, to say I believe she would be an excellent choice, and I think she's a very serious choice. Ash Carter, I think, is doing a good job where he is. So if Michelle Flournoy were not the choice of Mrs. Clinton, then Secretary Clinton, President Clinton, might choose to stay with the current situation. And if she doesn't wind up with either of those two choices, I think the guy to my far right here today would be a pretty darn good choice himself.
Bear
so
me.
Thank you all for being here.